Herzlich willkommen.
Naja, möglicherweise werde ich auch einige Missverständnisse bestätigen. Wir werden sehen, woraus rausläuft. Okay, but as this talk is announced in English, I'll continue in English. I hope that the language isn't really a barrier, looking at the number of participants here. The room was much fuller in the morning. So I hope you can follow. If you have any questions, please ask them immediately. I think we have enough time to get through the presentation as well as answering questions while presenting. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the necessary stuff. Why is HP, or why would HP Labs, for whom I'm working, be interested in trusted computing? Some of you may know that HP has been a founding member of both the TCPA organization, Trusted Computing Platform Alliance, which kicked off the trusted computing efforts. It's also a member of the TCG, Trusted Computing Group Consortium, that followed up the work of the TCPA. It has contributed substantially to the standards of trusted computing in various working groups, and it also has the technical directorship of Trusted Computing Group and TCPA since its very beginning. It also now holds the board directorship of the Trusted Computing Group since April 2006, so our stakes in trusted computing are quite substantial. HP is also a vendor of trusted computing-enabled platforms. This mainly concerns notebooks and desktops that are geared towards the corporate environment. And trusted computing hardware is employed and supported by a software suite called ProtecTools that currently runs under Windows. The software suite enables you to use trusted computing locally for useful purposes such as protecting your cryptographic keys. You can protect hardware encryption keys and so on. But the major remark to be made here is that it works locally on your machine and doesn't support any kind of remote interaction that is based on trusted computing right now. HP is also interested in trusted computing because the applicability for trusted computing concepts may be wider than just PCs or servers. This may also concern handhelds or printers, for example. There are numerous environments where printing is subjected to strict policy rules, and also the documents that can be printed on specific printers are tagged. So this might be a useful feature, if only because also printers can be hacked, which some people may not be aware of. In particular, HP is also providing solutions and services for security-critical environments. Sorry, and this is where the customers come from, who actually ask for trusted computing solutions. So, a little extension to the heading. Oh, slightly out of focus. I don't know whether this can be fixed. Anyone up there? Otherwise, you just have to guess what's at the left-hand side, but typically there are only a couple of characters missing, at the bullet points, importantly. So, why would HP be interested in open trusted computing, so an open approach to trusted computing? Well, first of all, we have no specific agenda when it comes to operating systems and applications. HP supports a pretty large range of operating systems, and official support is being given for HP UX, Microsoft Windows, and Linux. Whether we want it or not, if we have customers in these segments, we just have to follow their requests and their needs. HP is also the largest provider of Linux-based servers, with more than 1 million platforms currently installed all over the world, and this is where the customer base comes from that has these demands. And finally, HP is also a very well-respected contributor to the open-source environment, and we take the discussion and debate in this environment pretty seriously and try to address issues if ever possible. So I talked about customer demands. Part of the motivation of open trusted computing actually comes from concrete requirements about, we heard about what Microsoft may or may not do with trusted computing. Is there anything you are doing or someone is doing in the trusted computing and open source arena? Will this be supported? What are current initiatives in the open source environment, and so on. For a number of years, as you may know, the debate has been pretty controversial, and very little efforts could be seen in this arena. So this was something where HP thought we might actually want to step in as a company here in order to, well, at least generate some momentum in this area, because, well, the interests of our customers are typically well beyond the typical interests of single Linux users, so to speak. We're talking about people who are running data centers with thousands of nodes in highly security critical environments, and they couldn't be less bothered about the overall opinion of the of some open source developers and the environment. They were more concerned about what solutions they can actually have in the foreseeable future. So HP, to sum this up, has a stake in both trusted computing, a substantial one, and also a substantial one in the open source or free and open source arena. And this is why we are actually are interested in tackling this kind of problem. So I don't want to give an introduction here about trusted computing. Probably the trusted computing group isn't the best group anymore to give these presentations. I've listened to Himmelein's presentations on previous Linux days, which were actually excellent in terms of technical descriptions. The slides may still be available, and it's also too comprehensive to address this. So I confine myself to stating that it's a set of specifications that has been produced by industry working groups or working groups. The whole initiative was started by a number of large IT companies in 1999, and the successor organization is now the Trusted Computing Group. The main core component and the main stumbling block in the debate about trusted computing is the Trusted Platform module. It's a piece of hardware that is embedded on computing platform and provides some functionalities that, well, security people think is nice and other people think it's less nice. As for the core functionality, cryptographic functions can be executed on this in a protected way. Cryptographic secrets can be protected, so they will never be touched outside the hardware and can't be snooped. Trusted computing modules also allow to reliably log state information into registers that reside on these chips. So they can't be targeted and modified in a specific way without this being noticed. And finally, probably one of the more advanced features that have been little exploited so far, trusted computing and the hardware supports to bind cryptographic secrets to a known good platform state, or to any platform state for that matter. So if you logged your boot up state into the trusted computing hardware, you can define keys that are actually locked to this state information. If the state information changes, the key isn't usable anymore, so the data can only be accessed if the platform is in a state you think is fit for purpose to access data or initiate network connections, and so on and so on. I slightly changed the order of my presentation, as this is the technical track. And I want to get the technical brief across before actually getting into more philosophical discussions and discussions about motivations of OpenTC and why we think this is actually necessary. So this is the OpenTC project in a nutshell on one single slide. What we tried to do was to find stakeholders from industry and also from academia, especially from industry, who are in a position that is similar to HP. So they have both a stake in trusted computing as one of the members or even promoters on the one hand, but also have a large interest in the open source arena. And if you look at the participants, hopefully all of them are printed without losing anything on the left-hand side. The industrial partners are AMD, HP, Infineon, IBM, and SUSE Novell. So all of them are stakeholders in this area. Probably Infineon currently to a lesser extent, but they're also interested to have their chips supported on as many platforms and on as many operating systems as possible. This defines their interest. As for the academic partners, I couldn't list all of them because 23 is a rather large number. Notably, we involve the University of Cambridge, so the Xen developer team there. Probably most of you have heard about Xen as, well, probably the most interesting virtualization layer at this stage. We also involve the University of Dresden Bochum here in Germany, and this is because these guys have developed a microkernel-based architecture for more than 10 years now.
just more focused on real-time behavior. Bochum specifically targeting security architectures that are based on microkernels. And we try two parallel approaches in order to investigate what is the nicest way in order to provide some kind of virtualization machine monitor, either based on Xen or L4, that will allow for guaranteeing security properties for hosted Linux instances. I can't dig into the details right now, but currently both approaches are not true virtualization and also not a compilation on the fly, as you might know from VMware. It's para-virtualization, meaning that vanilla Linux kernel actually have to be recompiled to run on these layers. Other than this, performance overhead is relatively minute, so for a typical task, you wouldn't spot the difference between something that is hosted under Xen or L4 for that matter, or running natively on the hardware. Well, this all depends on how much load you put on the system. As for the project duration, 3 years or 3.5 years with roll-off, and kickoff was end of last week. End of last year. The goal of OpenTC is to exploit trusted computing technology for free and open source-based systems, and the core idea is to use virtualization or parallel virtualization as a basic architecture for trusted platforms. Underlying idea is you try to separate things that are security critical in different respects and try to isolate them from each other so no transgression takes place. Also ensuring that even if you might hack one component or address one component, you can't subvert the whole system. You've heard a little presentation about SE Linux this morning. SE Linux, you can imagine, provide similar functionalities, security domains, or policy domains. Our goal is to do a similar thing with a much coarser policy, but using virtualization. And I'll talk about the potential benefits of using a virtualization approach later on. I mentioned a couple of work packages. So this is a pretty comprehensive project. It includes hardware-based or hardware-related activities for the trusted computing hardware, as well as new CPUs from Intel and AMD, the software stack, or TSS as it's called, in trusted computing lingo, that interfaces the trusted computing hardware, the virtualization layers and the trust properties, management of trusted virtualization, public key infrastructure, which is necessary for the whole trusted computing approach. You have to deal with quite a number of keys there. Protocols. We hope to integrate things like SSL or SSH to interface these trusted compartments. A couple of application prototypes to demonstrate the usefulness. Mobile platforms, where we want to see whether trusted computing is actually useful in these more closed environments, but running open source software. And then we have packages on validation and quality assurance on one hand and dissemination on another. As you've seen, SUSE is part of this, and as they're already supporting Xen in their current distribution, they're also interested in taking this a little bit further with regard to trustworthiness and security. So what's the starting point or the coordinate or the thoughts behind an open approach to trusted computing? Well, this is a quite general and clear idea. No one will trust everyone, and not everyone will trust a single entity. If, you have a friend, but you are my enemy, then I may have less reasons to trust your friend than I may have to trust my friends. So we can't anticipate a situation where you just have one single root of trust or one provider of software and trustworthiness out there in the world. There will always be at least two, probably even more, and OpenTC takes this into account by suggesting a genuine architectural approach that is geared towards solving this problem. It's also clear that trusted computing, if it becomes of importance as technology on a wider scale, should work across different platform types, it should work across different OSs, because at the end of the day, everything is connected with everything these days.
The issue of trust and trustworthiness, well, can be tackled in different ways. You can just define that something is trustworthy because you are the vendor of it, but probably a better approach and also a more scientific approach would be to agree on something being trustworthy between independent partners. So we would start this as a collaborative effort, which is what we are doing in this project. And as I already mentioned, sorry, there's a typo. You should involve trusted computing TCG members who are also OSS stakeholders, which we did. What were the major concerns in the debate about trusted computing so far? Well, as you all know, the fear of customer lock-in, especially the fear of customer lock-in with regard to proprietary software, was one of the major points of contention there. And this is something we'd actually like to address by supporting an alternative architecture and platform. So we try to prove the feasibility of trusted computing for open source software, and we also want to take care that the trusted computing architecture we come up with provides flexibility and choice to the maximum that is possible for the user while still maintaining useful security and trust properties for parts, at least parts of the system. And well, as I mentioned, this is a European-funded project. It's no coincidence. The major debate was raging here in Europe, probably the very major one here in Germany. I don't know why this is the case, but in Brussels, for example, people and decision makers are reading German press in order to get informed about trusted computing, and they say that's good enough because the discussion is most detailed here, including the public discussion. So this was a very, even the critics provided a good preparation for putting forward the suggestion of doing this in an open space as a research project, and finally the Commission said, well, we think it's a good idea, so try to go ahead with it. So now for some technical details here, what we are trying to do is to use virtualization, as I mentioned, basically to maintain information flow properties and isolation of policy domains. We want to use the virtualization layers, this should read provide rather than proves, to provide for compartments or policy domains that have defined information flow properties. Both your virtualization layer and these compartments should boot up in a fashion that is audited and attested by trusted computing mechanisms. So you would actually lock your boot up state into the trusted computing module and thereby have a means to prove that compartments that you start with a specific policy are actually working as expected and the policy is enforced. The compartments, well, if I talk about the compartments, you could imagine a whole Linux instance sitting on top of a virtualization layer. These compartments come with the policies attached and will be started by the virtualization layer this phone just disturbs the microphone. I try to switch this up, off. I was just saying the compartments will be started in conjunction with the policies or information flow policies that are attached to it, and it will work like a mandatory access control mechanism. So the virtualization layer should actually make sure that if you started a compartment that is tagged as being non-interferable, can't actually be interfaced by an entity, either a local entity or a remote entity that isn't included in the information flow policy in the first place. We don't quite know to what extent we can actually drive this, but we would like to drive this to a point that is similar to SA Linux approach. So even if there is an administrator or root account on this system, it should still make sure that these policies are obeyed to, or that the system closes down or doesn't work properly if you try to interfere, but just says, well, you try to tamper with this, I bring down this compartment because the policies can't be enforced anymore. I talked about flexibility and choice. The interesting approach, I think, is that you can run lockdown operating system instances or software components, for that matter, alongside ordinary ones. So you would, if you have a situation where you have to work with your corporate environment and your corporate system administrators want to make sure that your system is actually in a proper state to connect to the company internal network, you would start a compartment that has a configuration that is known to the administrators, and this compartment would be now allowed to proceed with accessing the internal network. In parallel, you could start another compartment, which is just your plain vanilla Linux, which you administer as root and with your own privileges and to your own liking. But the system, the remote system, would actually make sure that your vanilla system isn't supposed to connect to your corporate network. So you may have the best of two worlds, and this probably, to some extent, does away with the general problem that was raised in the trusted computing discussion, namely that, well, trusted computing assumes one operating system on a machine. If I want to run a trustworthy environment, then it will be the whole machine, and the administrator has no choice but to obey rules that are probably defined from the outside world. Some of these rules may be defined by your corporate administrators and so on, but it shouldn't affect your whole platform anymore. You should run your private stuff in parallel to your corporate stuff, or things that are subjected to policies and contracts in parallel with things that are supposed to run uninhibited. And hopefully this will work. What we're trying to do is to explore the next generation of x86 features. There was also some mention of these features in the previous talks. Basically, we will be able to use improved protection mechanisms for memory and I.O., so for separation. The CPUs will also support mechanisms for secure initialization, and notably, they will come with hardware support for virtualization. So this may do away with the need of using a kernel that are specifically compiled towards virtualization layer, because you could end up in a situation where you can run a Linux out of the box on top of this virtualization layer, because everything else will be taken care of. It would be a nice situation, but there's a caveat. You may believe it or not, our hardware people have often some difficulties in understanding this, but virtualization, proper virtualization, hardware-supported virtualization, may be less efficient than para-virtualization. So it may actually be slow, because more of state has to be rescued and so on. So you may have to pay a penalty, but still running something out of a box like an ordinary distribution on top of such a virtualization layer would be a very nice thing. And, well, finally, we want to explore some new features that come with trusted computing platform modules as defined in the latest version of the specification. Okay, let's come up with some diagrams. This is an idealized view about what we hope to implement. You have the physical hardware on the bottom, so CPU chipset and the TPM on the right-hand corner. On top of this, you have a virtualization layer. So this will be Xen or L4 or the security enhanced version Perseus as developed in Bochum. On top of this, you will need a couple of services that make use of the virtualization layer and also provide for some basic functionality. So you need some management component that enforces the policies, something that interfaces with the TPM. You may want some secure storage. There will be a presentation about one of these concepts later on today. And a couple of other services. All these services are, they're just boxed into something called trusted software layer, and all this is the security kernel or your trusted computing base you will actually work with. If you keep these services reasonably small, then you may have a better chance of actually saying something about the virtualization layer and its properties. We hope that we can reduce the size, which is one important thing with regard to Linux. Linux is rather big. Hopefully these virtualization layers are smaller, so it will be easier to actually subject them to evaluation and easier to test. This is a massive problem for the traditional operating systems. Well, and on top of this, you actually have your virtual machines or compartments, as I named them before,
that run, ordinary Linux have some virtual drivers and processes that will perform specific tasks. And you could imagine one of these just being dedicated for your banking applications. It will have firewall rules that apply just for these virtual machines, as well as policies that guard the inter-process or interaction between virtual machines on the local host. So it should be reasonably locked down for these purposes. That's the idea in its basic core.
Those of you who have worked with Xen, experimented with Xen, will spot some kind of blind spot in the last diagram, because you may know that Xen actually requires Linux on top of it in order to do anything useful. It provides the management environment for starting and stopping other virtual machines. So this just addresses the mapping to Xen for L4, the kernel I mentioned before. We can come closer to this idealized view because the microkernel architecture allows a better separation of security critical services that run natively. For Xen, it would basically look like this. You would have DOM 0 on the left hand side. You would put the trusted services inside the DOM 0 that is actually running there. And from there on, you would initiate other virtual machines, starting and stopping them. Hopefully, this Linux will be a very, very stripped-down version, so it should be smaller than an ordinary distribution. You wouldn't run your full-fledged installation there. But we'll see how this pans out. There is some kind of evolutionary approach. If you actually, if you just make a sum, looking at this diagram, you have the virtualization layer plus Linux, so the whole system is actually bigger than an ordinary Linux. This isn't exactly what you might call reducing the trusted computing base. You may very well be able to reduce the attack surface for any of your hosted services that have to be secured. But in terms of size, this is actually bigger than Linux itself. So the evolutionary approach would be something that is possible under Xen, perfectly natural for L4, but hasn't been exploited under Xen so far, which is it is actually possible to run threads natively on Xen. So if you want to reduce your trusted computing base, you would try an approach that actually builds these services probably under Linux to have your ordinary development environment and do the testing and so on, but you would try to develop them in a way that one recompilation process might be good enough, or recompilation of stubs, in order to run these services natively on the virtualization layer. And in this case, you could step by step make yourself more independent from Linux as the hosting system for your managed and trusted services. This is the idea. We will exploit this and we'll see to what extent we can actually drive it. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the core activities. It should become pretty clear that a large part of the activities is geared towards this trusted OS or virtualization layer. What we want to have is a common view on Xen and L4 when it comes to management of virtual machines, starting, stopping, suspending, migrating probably, and also a common view on basic trusted computing functionalities. We will proceed in two steps. First of all, you want to have some kind of common interface. You type the same commands and get the same results on both Xen and L4. This would already get you somewhere. In a second step, you would actually try to do this with a library-based approach, where you may even tweak the interface between the kernel and the virtualization layer in order to come to some more common view. And we would also need some kind of common expression for policies that guard the information flow and the mandatory access policy on the one hand, and a description for the configuration, because the configuration of your virtual machine environment will actually dictate its behavior. So these are the first two steps. Last one is, we will need at least a good subset of the functionality provided by a trusted platform module, and this is part of the activities to create the interface there. A second major block is concerned with managing these machines. So
as you've seen this activity, this is about large managed environments, mainly servers at this stage, because virtualization is actually a large driver in server consolidation. It is easy to sell, so both HP and Intel and IBM are interested in this area. And this has to be managed. Your keys have to be managed. Probably you have to migrate trust environments from one server to the next environment. So how do you do this if you have a hard-rooted base of trust? There are some difficult questions there that will have to be tackled. And we will need a couple of services. We will need agents that run on these machines in order to make this manageable, and so on and so on. Okay, this is the technical content or the technical description of what we're trying to do very brief words. Now, a couple of words during the last couple of minutes we have about, what is the motivation beyond all this? The question we had to address increasingly was, can free and open source software actually afford to ignore trusted computing, given the liveliness of the debate and partial hostility to trusted computing and the open source environment? It was clear that very little efforts outside the academic environment would be undertaken by the communities themselves in order to combine those two technologies. Personally, I've always thought that this is a pretty bad idea, because in this case you just have one solution or a couple of them, and all will be proprietary. And this might not be an alternative, at least not for several of our customers. Trusted computing, when it comes to remote attestation, which I will talk about on the next slide, without trusted computing, you have to assume adversarial trust models. So as a good system administrator, you will know how secure or trustworthy your own system is. But if the success of any transaction depends not only on your system, but also on a couple of remote ones, then you're actually stuffed. So the SE Linux solutions that have been put forward in the last presentations were actually pretty good. But how does the other guy at the other end know that you're running SE Linux? Currently, there's no mechanism that would allow you to prove this. And the Trusted Computing Group still maintains that you need embedded hardware on a system and actually provide this proof. There is no other way around it. At least during the last 7 years, no alternative to this concept has been put forward. So the statement still holds. A rather unpleasant situation may occur if judges, for example, may declare trusted computing as state of the art in the foreseeable future. In certain environments, you have to stick to the state of the art, and you may think of a number of large organizations that replace parts of their back-end systems with non-proprietary or free and open source-based systems. And just by such a ruling, they may be forced to throw out their infrastructure and go back to proprietary again, because they can't support the state of the art with the open source infrastructure. Clearly, this is no alternative at all for a large number of customers who have pretty much invested in this. And one aspect that has been little discussed, there are one or two web spaces out there that have a comprehensive discussion on this, but probably if trusted computing and remote attestation might prove to be important in future, then an open approach to trusted computing may have inherent advantages. I don't have to remind you about attempts to use any kinds of policy enforcing software to introduce Trojans that do something that is related to their original goal, but also something that clearly isn't. This can be done if you do this in a closed software form. This will be much, much harder if you do this on an open software basis, because if you accept that you need policy components in there, that you run mutually assured policy contracts on your own system, you still want to know that this policy component does nothing else than just enforcing this policy, instead of sifting your through your system and doing all kinds of crazy stuff. So if you start from the assumption, if you accept that this is a useful concept, then at least my opinion is I'd rather have this open than closed. I'd like transparent mechanisms that can be evaluated by independent peers. The second large advantage is
the development of such systems could actually happen in the way typical for open source based development, which is people can agree on what features they think are desirable for their systems and which clearly aren't. And what isn't desirable won't be implemented or will only be implemented by a subset of users rather than be forced down the throat of users. So again, this is mainly due to customer concerns. The question we got was, will trusted computing be supported for open source based solution? And we could point to quite a number of academic efforts that were exploiting combinations of trusted computing and open source, but to no industry initiative and also not to any sizable open source or independent open source effort. This is why we actually stepped in there. We also stepped in there because we thought that a couple of concerns that were raised again and again and again were factually wrong. So the notion that trusted computing may put open source at a disadvantage or necessarily lead to customer lock-ins or that it's philosophically incompatible with open source system, I think are all bogus. The technology itself is passive, it's policy neutral, and whatever will be done of, with this technology will depend mainly on the operating system and enforcement mechanisms that are sitting on top of this. But this is software. And, well, software is negotiable, at least if you develop it the open source way. The last point I've written down here would deserve a presentation on its own. So you may know that currently there's a draft out there for GPL version 3. And some of the new paragraphs actually tackle digital rights management technology. Although it doesn't specifically target trusted computing, GPL3 might become a problem for attempts of ours or similar attempts just to make enforcement mechanisms that are open. And the debate is really controversial. So from what I can see, it splits the developer communities right in the middle. Linus Torvalds says, with the current draft version, I will not subject the kernel efforts to GPL version 3, whereas Stallman sticks by his gun and actually wants these passages in. I don't know whether there will be any presentation here on the Linux talk, but I'd be interested in responses from the developers' communities on how they will actually react to this, because you may end up in a situation where the kernel is under GPL version 2, the two parts of the tool chain are under GPL version 3. How do you consolidate this from a provider's point of view, such as HP? This is a licensing nightmare, and from our point of view, the last thing we need is yet another open source license in order to make matters more difficult than they already are. So the challenges which I put forward to this auditorium, but also the challenges we try to address, is who defines what is trusted and how could such a definition be achieved in the open source environment? For proprietary software, this might be more straightforward, if only because a vendor just says, trust me, I signed the binary, be done with it. We have a good brand name and are always good to our customers, so you don't need to ask further questions because it's our brand and probably our liability that is behind there. But for open source based systems, this is much, much more involved. I won't mention, because I'm encouraged not to mention this, problems that may actually be caused by the GPL. Which waives warranty and any kind of responsibility for software that is out there, risk-wise, you're on your own. Okay, now you can attempt to buy in external consultancy or support from small and medium-sized companies that would actually give you guarantees for specific types of software. But this still is a contract between you and a service provider. This doesn't scale the worldwide scale. So how could actually the whole open source community benefit from this kind of supportive action? And who would give the signature saying that, okay, this is a management agent or whatever, and this does what it's supposed to do. It does nothing more and nothing less. And what about modifiability? So if you tweak this agent, the GPL allows you to do this, but security-wise, your attestation may go bust because whoever went through the code hasn't seen what you've been done, and without reevaluation, the security assurances can't be maintained. So this is a question of trusted as by branded signature and corporations probably, versus trustworthiness that has to be achieved on a wide scale in an open source environment. And well, the discussion in IT security has found no evidence that just by virtue of openness, open source software is more secure than proprietary software. So this argument is clearly bogus. You will need some kind of additional assurances, and the question is, how do we go about this? We will try to find some methodologies and development models in order to make software development slightly better, or probably easier to evaluate, but the problem itself can't be addressed by open trust computing. This is a question that has to be pushed out there and discussed in the developers' community. As I mentioned before, main challenge was, do we have to lock down the whole platform? I think with our approach, this might not be necessary. We say, just go virtual, do trusted stuff in trusted compartments, and your vanilla stuff in vanilla compartments, and be done with it. Clearly, you need to maintain a trusted state of a trusted compartment during the whole time of the interactions with remote parties or during the access to confidential data. The dilemma, as I see it, and Stallman's position of putting arguments forward is a very individualistic perspective. So this assumes being God on your machine, being a knowledgeable administrator who wants to be able to tweak each and every bit on the machine in each and every situation, which is good for computer whizzes, but there are ever fewer of these computer whizzes who understand what is actually going on these machines. And for most people who are using computers these days, they're actually stuffed. No one really understands what's going on about this, and my image of the future. We will need some kind of collaborative or multilateral approach to the whole security problem if we are talking distributed systems. So it's not good enough for me to know that I am capable of configuring my system in a way that it's secure. I may want to know the same thing about a remote entity, and probably I would also want to know this if I'm working in some kind of grid or peer-to-peer environment. So to talk in an image, if I want to rent out parts of my computer for a goal I subscribe to, I want to make sure that these activities are properly isolated from my individual work. And if I set up such a service, I may also want to know that the remote systems I'm roping in are in a state that are fit for this collaborative purpose. So this is one of the things you can't go around. I depicted the underlying problem here in this diagram just to state that you have a social contract, so two individuals want to achieve a goal, and you have an underlying infrastructure that can actively change the communication. So I may type in yes at the other end, there will be a no appearing, and now the question of the receiver is, where does this no actually come from? Was it the user who typed it in? Was it the remote machine that changed a yes into a no, probably? Or is my own machine subverted that changes a yes for a no? If you want to have this legally sound, then you will have to include properties of the underlying infrastructure, saying this infrastructure is fit for purpose, and for all we know, it can't be changed in a way that it supports user input and output, and therefore the whole electronic contract is valid. Currently, you can't do this. Can't we just have to hope that what I type will actually arrive at the other end without being modified by our infrastructure? And I listed a couple of examples why this might actually be useful. You may want to remember this word down there, compact. That's an old expression of the English contract. Has been investigated by Martin Rush-Eisen in the mid-90s. It's actually a part of the contract that includes the features of your IT infrastructure, stating this contract is valid in this technical context, and we can prove that this context was present when we made this agreement. Okay, final words about trust and managed infrastructures. From a service provider point of view, virtualization in itself is a pretty attractive value proposition because you need less iron, you may reduce management, you may reduce energy costs, or something that can easily be explained to your bean counters, and it's a major driving force in the current environment. But for your customers, it may actually create a problem because they may have been used to rent a piece of iron from you, so a real server, that's yours, you define your operating system and what you want to run on this, and at least had a mental concept about what this means. Okay, it's my machine. If you go to virtualized environments, you don't have this direct notion anymore. You may run multiple instances of operating systems for different customers that may even be competing, and these customers may want to have some notion that the isolation properties you provide with virtualized infrastructure are at least as good as those that were provided on the bare metal. And both the technical approach to trusted virtualization and the way you can attest to platform properties may give customers a better assurance about what is actually going on. So we want to maintain this idea of owning a platform in a virtualized world, and we hope that trusted computing can help us with this. We'll also have to manage these properties across heterogeneous environments, so I foresee a future where the same trust properties have to be stated and proven for different operating systems. Currently, no one is addressing this problem, and probably we can try to do this. And finally, you may have all noticed that questions of compliance and auditability become ever more important for at least a subset of customers of yours who are subjected to legal regulations, best practices, and so on and so on. We wouldn't know how to maintain this notion of compliance and especially auditability if we don't use trusted computing in this way, because for virtualized instances you can say very little about where they reside and what their context was and so on. Okay, a couple of challenges. We have more than we like, actually. The question is, how do you actually define the expected behavior and of an operating system, and how do you do this on different virtualization layers? So we would like a canonical representation of policies and configurations describing what these virtual machines can and can't do. Currently, not very much in this area. We would, as for SA Linux, we will need templates for trusted configurations. So SA Linux, for example, was pretty much unusable for ordinary users for a long time, if only because it was so difficult to configure in the first place. So this situation is now being addressed by standard templates that may cover 80% of all use cases for ordinary customers. This is the right direction, but these templates actually have to be generated by someone. One problem I already mentioned, who will actually validate configuration and components and say, well, this is trustworthy for a specific purpose. There are all kinds of problems. Different institutions have to agree on this. Different geographical or economical blocks have to agree on this. We are talking with people in Japan or China or in Latin America who have their own ideas about what they consider to be trustworthy, and there has to be some agreement there. So if you consider this problem on a global scale, then you actually have some work at your hands. And the last thing is, if you want to state trust properties not only for your compartment but also for applications running in these compartments, we currently have very little description about what programs are actually supposed to be doing. To some extent, we even lack documentation, but we certainly don't have any specification or more abstract model that can be used in order to monitor application and say, well, they are still in a known good state or they may not be. So some research in anomaly detection may come to our help here, but we will probably need this kind of descriptions, and someone has to write them, or they have to be derived from source code. Whatever the mechanisms will be, this is an area to investigate. Finally, trusted compilation. Will we need this? So even if you compile code that has been signed by someone who says it's okay,
there may be compiler flags or dates or whatever, and this, they may change the layout of the binary and the hash, and in this case, your hash will differ from something that has been compiled from a trusted space, so you may actually need instances that compile stuff for you in order to create the same binaries that produce the same matrix for the trusted computing module. There are more problems, but I'll save you from mentioning that. I think these are already hard enough. I'll stop here in order to give some room for questions. Thank you for your time and attention, and should there be any students or postgraduates who are interested in this area of trusted virtualization, this project is still ongoing, and we have a couple of racks for students or postgrads who may be interested in either security, trusted computing, or virtualization, and just write down my name and contact me if you're interested to spend a couple of months even more with the Hewlett-Packard Labs to research this subject in our context. Okay, thank you very much.
Any questions? Scary, no questions. Yes, you could certainly use the architecture in exactly these scenarios, and some of the use cases we are working on actually try to reflect exactly this. So we call it corporate computing from home. So you have one environment where you have very stringent security policies about what can access critical data or what can connect to certain segments of your network. So you will use one of these instances exactly for this. And on the other hand, you have your personal environment. It is in line with the policy of many companies who allow at least partial private use of corporate systems to their employees and also allow private system of employees to connect to their virtual private networks with all problems that are involved with this. So this is a major problem for getting viruses into the infrastructure. What you are describing is a real world physical air gap, probably even two different networks, and we will try to provide a virtual air gap and save one machine, probably making things more convenient for end users. Yes, absolutely. In fact, there is. So there is a version of Trusted Grub out there developed by Ruhr University Bochum. This can be downloaded. So this Grub actually supports logging data into the TPM. For virtualized scenarios, this might be a little bit more involved because you want to measure both your VMM and a Linux version that is running as hosting environment. There have been some good investigations about how to actually combine Linux or even SE Linux with trusted computing. This work was mainly done by IBM Watson and by IBM Japan, who combined trusted Linux or SE Linux in this case and trusted computing. The results were interesting but also mixed because it became clear that you have to actually measure hundreds of components before you get to your first boot log. So in terms of complexity, this is quite difficult. If you just think of the combinatorial space you might have to cover to define trusted configurations, that's really, really hard. So we hope that with the virtualization approach, we can reduce this space to a considerable degree. So you just prove that your BIOS has been checked, your virtualization layer has been checked, and the virtualization layer has the sole and most important property of A, providing isolation, B, starting compartments with attached policies, and C, make the system as non-subversible as ever possible, meaning it shouldn't be possible to disable the policy once you started a compartment. You can shoot down the compartment, that's okay, but the compartment should stick to its policy, and there should be as little as possible options to subvert the policy. That's all. So the virtualization layer comes without any specific policies, just says once you state a policy or two guys agree on a policy, this policy will be started with the compartment and the policy will be enforced by the virtualization layer. End of story. Whatever you negotiate at being a suitable policy is completely up to you. This is in the making, but there's not very much out there. Probably you can find something on IBM server at this stage, because they actually built a prototype about using remote attestation in a server environment. But I couldn't really say yes to whether they actually published the code on this. The papers are certainly published. I wouldn't know about the code. Probably it's there. All right, in this case, I think I'll finish, because there are two more minutes for the next presenter. Thank you again, and anyone who wants to contact me, I'll be at the entrance over there if someone wants to talk to me.